Welcome to the premiere episode of Real Talk, the talk show about anything. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'll be here every Wednesday at 11 a.m. with interesting guests who'll bring us insights on all kinds of topics. We open on this International Women's Day with the power of sisterhood and a walk through the history of the women's movement and insights on where it stands now. Our guest is Melanie Klein, author and sociology professor in women's studies at Moorpark College. Welcome, Melanie.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is a delight, and we are honored that you're here, particularly to provide us with insights from your expertise and I suspect your many years of study of the women's history movement, of the women's movement, rather. History tells us the U.S. women's movement started in 1848 with the first women's rights convention in Seneca, New York. Do you agree with that, and what would you mark as important moments in the movement since then?
Yes, I would agree that officially the women's movement did start in Seneca Falls, New York, at the Seneca Falls Convention in July of 1848. With that said, though, I do want to point out that there were obviously decades leading up to that particular moment in Seneca Falls, New York. And that also when we think about the women's movement, I always want to clarify that, you know, the women's movement is not something that is unique to the United States, nor did that moment in Seneca Falls somehow imply that was the beginning of some sort of feminist consciousness among women in the United States in particular. You know, if we think about activity among women and their allies for women's rights and equality, this has been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years throughout the globe and, you know, throughout history. And in when we talk about, you know, in the United States, one thing that always struck me as so fascinating was that when the nation was being formed, Abigail Adams had already written to her husband, John Adams, asking him to, quote, remember the ladies, and talking about freedom. And that was 72 years prior to Seneca Falls. And clearly the founding fathers, including John Adams, did not include women in the Declaration of Independence or in the Constitution. So that was already on the minds of many women at the beginning of the nation's founding. Were these rights in terms of, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, was this notion of equality going to be extended to all people, including women in all their diversity, or was this only going to be something that was going to apply to certain people? And certainly if we look back at our history, it only applied to certain people, namely to white land-owning men.
Yes.
So that was really on the minds of many women. It took 72 years until the meeting at Seneca Falls happened, which was over the course of several days in Seneca Falls, New York. And then I also like to point out that it took another 72 years for that particular movement to achieve its primary goal, which was women's suffrage, which was amended in 1920. So I always like my students to add up those numbers.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And we realized that we were a nation for 144 years before women were voting. And we also have to consider that there were even more obstacles specifically for black women that went on until the early 1960s around voting. And that if we look that in 2017, we've been a nation for 241 years, that women have actually only been able to exercise the right to vote for about 40% of this nation's history. I always think those numbers are quite revealing. But certainly that is when the women's movement began in earnest at the Seneca Falls Convention. But I also like to point out to people that, you know, the notion of suffrage was actually not one of the primary agenda items when these women and their male allies went to meet in Seneca Falls. A lot of women, including the very progressive, if not radical, Quaker women, felt that the idea of asking for the vote was actually going to be too much and that the entire movement, yes, would be discredited, and that it was actually Elizabeth Cady Stanton who had really sort of encouraged her sisters to ask for the vote. And interestingly enough, the great abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass, who was in the audience had agreed and let Elizabeth Cady Stanton's sisters know that it was incredibly important for women to ask for the vote in the same way that it was not enough for the slave to be free, but the newly freed slave needed to be able to vote as well, that they were convinced to ask for that. And it was a very long haul, and it was also not the only thing that they were focusing on. In the 72-year span,
yeah.
There were many, many other goals and you know, sort of initiatives that were taking place. And collectively, since then, the women's movement has been the longest-running social movement in United States history. So I'm always quite moved at how it began. And, you know, I think it's important to look at the numbers that I had mentioned that gives everyone a sense of perspective. And I feel that educates not only girls and women about their lost history, but boys and men equally, that there are so many phenomenal things that girls and women have faced in terms of challenges and obstacles and overcome, that we've really been robbed of our collective history as women and as a nation to not know these names and not to know this particular struggle.
Yes, history does get written by the guys who won, basically.
Exactly.
And that's I'm curious about that 1848 Women's Convention. If they were not initially seeking the vote, what were they after?
Well, interestingly enough, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was one of the few non-Quaker women who was at the forefront of the movement and starting it, she had gone to the London Anti-Slavery Convention with her husband, Henry Brewster Stanton. Many of the early first-wave feminists were very much a part of the Native American rights, vegetarianism, the temperance movement later on, as well as the abolitionist movement to free slaves. And upon being there, interestingly enough, she had met Lucretia Mott, who was a Quaker minister, who was a kind of woman she had never met before, who very active in her religion and her church and outspoken. And they were very keen on speaking on behalf of slaves. And then they were told that all women needed to sit in a cordoned-off section.
Whoa.
And it was at that moment, yes, that they realized that they had no rights themselves. And they had decided when they came back to Seneca Falls, or to the United States, rather, they were planning on putting together a women's rights convention. So just women's rights in terms of, you know, having equality in terms of having rights over their own children, being able to seek a divorce, being able to practice medicine, being able to be a church leader. There were actually quite a few items on their list, but voting was actually not one of them, and it certainly was not the top item until the women understood that all of those other things that they were seeking would be made obsolete if they did not have the right to exercise the vote, and that really became the primary issue and what that what is known oftentimes as that wave of feminism is most well known for, is suffrage.
So they got the idea that their condition was heavily influenced by the politics and that they had to get involved in the politics in order to get what they wanted. Is that correct?
Well, yes, but also Lucretia Mott and Elizabeth Cady Stanton were very unusual in terms of Elizabeth Cady Stanton was a white woman who came from a wealthy family. Her father was a judge. Lucretia Mott, coming from the Quaker faith in which all people are seen as equal, including women, in many ways they didn't quite feel the same brunt of oppression that other women were feeling at that time, poor women, immigrant women, women of color, so on and so forth. So that was really their first awareness of how heavily oppressed women were, and they realized that all of the other issues they cared about, and like I had said, you know, the being part of the abolitionist movement and speaking out on behalf of slaves and seeking the freedom of slaves, that they weren't even able to fully participate in those movements because they were seen as lesser than, and that really jarred them, and they understood, well, not only do we have to be actively opposed to the oppression of, you know, for example, slaves, but we need to also simultaneously fight for our own rights because we can't even be full participants in this movement because we're being marginalized as women. And so they started to see the many different ways that people can be oppressed and the need to essentially tackle all of them.
Hmm. You are listening to Real Talk on the Voice of Vashon at 101.9 FM, KVSHLP, Vashon Island, Washington. I'm your host, Susan McCabe, and I'm talking with Melanie Klein, who is a professor of sociology and women's studies at Moorpark College and an author. We're talking about the history of the women's movement. And clearly, the women's movement somehow corresponds with the history of this nation. How would you, if you were looking at that time from 1848, that 72 years from 1848 till 1920, when the women got the vote, how would you see the history of the nation or the condition of the nation being impacted by or impacting the women's movement during that 72 years?
Well, there was, vehement backlash against the idea that women should participate. The notion was that women were inferior beings, that their brains were not designed for political thought or intellectual activity. In fact, there was a doctor in the late 1800s, Dr. Edward Clark, who said that if women were too intellectually stimulated, if they tried to learn and to be, you know, actively engaged in politics and intellectual pursuits, that they would become barren, that all of the energy from their uterus would travel to their brain.
You're kidding.
No. And so there were a lot of very strong beliefs about the notion that, you know, that was not a woman's proper place, that women had a very specific place to sort of uphold in society. And specifically for white upper class women, there was a certain idea. For working white class women, there was another idea. For women of color, there was another notion of femininity, and that, you know, each of them were to be in these very specific boxes and not to question those boxes, not to challenge those particular roles, because that they were inherently inferior to men, specifically white men, and that was the sort of justification for sexism. That was the justification for the inequality that existed. The justification was the status quo exists because you are not capable. You need to have men make decisions for you. And in many ways, that particular line of thinking still exists today, where if we look at when the global gag rule was just signed back in the first 2 days of the new administration, it was all men making this decision. And so often women are treated as children. Women are seen as irrational, overly emotional, incapable of making decisions, incapable of being logical and rational and reasonable. And so that particular period of time, those notions were even more accepted than they are today. So that very much influenced the notion that you women, the political spaces are not for you, that, you know, you are the property of your husbands, as are your children, which is why women had no rights over their own children if they, you know, had the audacity to leave their abusive spouses or things of that nature. So the norms and the, you know, historical period had everything to do with the justification of women's inequality as something that was normative, rational, reasonable, and should be wholly accepted. And to be honest, not only did many men accept this, but there were many women of that period who accepted those particular ideas. Susan B. Anthony once famously said, "We won't really be able to make any progress until all of these ninnies die out," because there were many women's organizations that were vehemently fighting against the suffrage movement and who were against the women's movement as a whole. They did not want to have their particular roles within patriarchy be challenged or questioned.
Gosh, and there's a whole lot of women who in this particular day and age have voted against their best interests as well.
Absolutely.
Let's fast forward a little bit through World War II and up to the women's movement of the 50s and the 60s with Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem. They had a bit of a different approach, each of them did, to the women's, what was called the women's liberation movement at that time.
Absolutely. And I think what's important to note that you just mentioned is that they had different approaches. Mm-hmm. And I'd actually like to connect that with the first wave while focusing on this particular period, which is, you know, to understand that feminism is not necessarily, you know, a monolithic, uniform concept or activity, that even during the, you know, the first wave of feminism, there were many different voices and leaders. And for example, women of color in the first wave of feminism were very, very marginalized because, you know, the mainstream women's movement was appealing to white Southern racist senators, because at that time they had to go state to state for suffrage. And so there were different approaches, different styles, different voices, and we see that in the women's liberation movement, which, interestingly enough, a lot of that grows out of the civil rights movement. So there's a, mm-hmm. a link, whereas the first wave, the suffrage movement, was very heavily influenced by the abolitionist movement, their activity and involvement there. Similarly, many of the early second wave feminists, or the women who started the women's liberation movement, as it's also called, were very involved in the civil rights movement, also had a sort of eye-opening notion of, oh, wow, we still need to fight specifically for women's rights. And Betty Friedan was one of the early leaders. She had really sort of shocked the nation with her book, The Feminine Mystique, especially because The Feminine Mystique seemed to write about a population that was seen as very sort of passive, as very, you know, sanitized and palpable, which was middle-class, white, suburban housewives. And so in many ways, I say she snuck feminism in through the back door of the kitchen and radicalized women, as she would say, like women in Peoria, Illinois. But in many ways, Betty Friedan was conservative. Definitely that changed towards the end of her life, but she was very much disturbed by a lot of the radical feminists in the late 60s who were talking not only about patriarchy, but talking about the heteronormative nature of patriarchy and the way that the family sustains male dominance. Mm-hmm. And she very pejoratively called lesbian feminists the Lavender Menace. So she, in many ways, was not open to being that radical, even though she was radical in many senses. Mm-hmm. But she wanted to be palatable to the mainstream. She wanted to only focus, quote, on women's rights, even though, obviously, women come in, you know, many different races and sexual orientations and gender identities. But that was not something that was really a part of her framework at that time. She had helped found with other women the National Organization of Women, and so her notion of liberal feminism to a certain degree was fairly conservative. I would say that Gloria Steinem, because in many ways she was on the front lines as a journalist and had done that expose on the Playboy clubs, she had been sort of elevated to this position because the notion of a, quote, sexy feminist was titillating and marketable. And she understood her responsibility in sharing the spotlight with others, which she did. But I actually find that radical feminists who challenged the sort of liberal feminist agenda of Betty Friedan are in many ways more interesting because they were talking about the intersectional nature of the female experience, that they were talking about having children and being married and being in the closet, and how we need to rail against patriarchy and homophobia and the heteronormative order. And they were very much interested in using guerrilla street theater tactics to be in your face and on the streets. They were the women responsible behind the No More Miss America pageant in 1968, where they crowned a sheep Miss America and they unfurled a huge banner you know, inside, and they had the Freedom trash can where they threw in their bras. And also black feminists and women of color in the 60s who were challenging the racism of the liberal feminist movement during that time, that, you know, their voices were not being heard. They were not in positions of leadership. So there was a lot going on. There were liberal feminists, radical feminists, women of color, and black feminist thought, and also Marxist feminists and socialist feminists who were bringing in, you know, the importance of talking about the economy and, you know, the power disparity, especially in families, when you're talking about having one person being the breadwinner and the other one exchanging their labor.
Yes.
You know, so there was a lot going on. It was a very, very vibrant time. And
sounds like
say,
the radical feminists were sort of broadening the embrace of the feminist movement from the Friedan position to a much larger cross-section of society, including, I think at that time, too, that women who were working and might have been the working poor or lower middle class felt excluded until Gloria Steinem and the radical feminists started speaking up. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Well, yes. I would say radical feminists really pushed the envelope. They were both necessary. I need to say that, you know, liberal feminism that was focusing a lot on laws and legislation and including women into the existing system, that was important. And then radical feminism, which was seeking to overhaul the entire system, to transform the system, and really talking about, you know, that we need to acknowledge that not all women are going to be straight, not all women are going to, you know, want to have this more conservative liberal agenda. That was important, for sure, to push the envelope for liberal feminism, to challenge liberal feminism to grow and stretch. But for me, really, the most profound and radical component of second wave feminism were women of color who kind of put it all together and brought up the notion of intersectionality, which was laterly coined in the early 90s by Kimberly Crenshaw. But the notion of looking at our intersecting experiences as women started in the 1970s, specifically with black women, where they said, you know, we're being marginalized by the civil rights movement and black liberation because we're women. And then we're being marginalized because we're women of color in the women's liberation movement. And we shouldn't have to pick one aspect of our identity over the other, that we all have a race. We all have a sexual orientation and gender identity. We all have a class. And we need to begin to understand how those things overlap and intersect with one another.
Yes, we do. And we are about out of time, so I want to approach you. I want to ask you one more sort of combined question, bringing us up to today. Two things. What are your views on what is called girl power today? And who would you consider? Who would you consider leaders of today's women's movement?
Okay, so girl power. That's a long answer. That could be a whole show in itself.
Oh dear. Okay, we'll do that.
I will say that girl power, in many ways, was a commodification of the early third wave feminists, young feminists such as Kathleen Hanna of Bikini Kill, and many of the young women who were doing their, you know, doing zines and DIY culture and really railing against patriarchy in a very new sort of youth-oriented way in the early 90s. And then that was sort of co-opted and then sold as girl power, which was a depoliticized notion of girls rock, girls rule, but that had no movement or collective struggle behind it. So talking just about girl power, I feel, completely erases the history and the collective struggle.
Okay.
I find that very problematic.
Yeah.
And in today's, you know, a lot of people see this as still being sort of the tail end of third wave feminism. Many say that this is, you know, an emergent wave of fourth wave feminism. But I would say that we don't have leaders that are as clearly defined as in the first and second wave. And I think that's fantastic because there are so many individuals and organizations doing incredibly important work on so many levels that now not only do we not have clearly defined leaders that we could just, you know, quickly point to, which I think is beneficial because there's so many. But we also have so many issues that now what has happened is that the feminist lens can be used on a variety of issues, looking at globalization, looking at poverty, looking at the digital divide, looking at eating disorders, looking at, you know, the experience of trans women, looking at domestic violence, that literally we have a diversity of issues, we have a diversity of voices, we have a diversity of styles. So I always say that the word that best defines where feminism is today is diversity, which is the legacy of the sort of intersectional perspective that women of color gave us at the end of the second wave. And I feel that that is the perspective that will continue to move us forward as we continue to struggle together.
Well, Melanie Klein, you have set up Real Talk for the next three shows in the month of March. So you've given us a great foundation for the rest of our month, which is going to be honoring Women's History Month here on Real Talk, 11 o'clock Wednesday mornings. And we're grateful to Vashon Theater, the island's one and only movie house since 1947, striving to have something for everyone. The Vashon Theater has expanded their offerings to include National Theater, Bolshoi Ballet, and Arts and Architecture series. Information about all films is at VashonTheater.com. Watch locally. And support for Voice of Vashon programming is also provided by KVSHFM, founding underwriter John L. Scott Vachon, Best People, Best Results. Melanie Klein, Professor of Sociology and Women's Studies and author, we are so grateful for your having joined us in this, our premiere show for Real Talk. The rest of the month, we're going to be addressing other topics relative to women. March 15th, we're going to cover women and madness, women's evolving image through culture and or the psychiatric profession. We're also going to be talking on March 22nd with Bree Mathers, who's going to cover The Skin You're In, which is about body image, the legacy of body image, and women in the media. And on March 29th, Riane Eisler, who is the author of The Chalice and the Blade, will talk to us about moving toward a caring economy, women and politics. So, Melanie, once again, you have set us up for the month, and I thank you so very much.
I have to thank you, Susan. This is one of my favorite things to talk about. And I just have to say how fangirled out I am on your guest for the rest of the month, especially Riane Eisler, who has been a huge influence on my perspective. So I hope listeners enjoy every moment. This is a very, very valuable conversation series. So thank you for having me kick it off.
Thank you. This has been Real Talk. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the rest of the VOV Day on KVSH 101.9 FM, Vashon Island, Washington.